Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. It is Thursday, April the 4th, 2024. Judging from the headlines, though, it might be April 1st, Fool's Day, but it's not a very cheerful Fool's Day. The headlines from the Wall Street Journal is that Donald Trump is leading Joe Biden in 6 of the 7 swing states. And the really sad thing is it makes sense given Biden's performance. Meanwhile, Steve Bannon, one of Donald Trump's ideological supporters, perhaps his key ideological supporter, is talking about the plan to rule for 100 years. It reminds one, of course, of the thousand-year Reich and the comparisons between Trump and his movement and Hitler and the Nazis is an endless one. Last month, we did a show with Peter Range about the comparison between Hitler and Trump. I have to admit, I'm not particularly convinced. Range is the author of an interesting book, 1924, The Year That Made Hitler. The only analogy he could make between Trump and Hitler is they both spoke about their enemies as vermin, which I'm sure is true and doesn't make either of them particularly attractive people, but I'm not convinced that it makes them alike. Anyway, we're back to the Trump-Hitler analogy today with another author, with another book, even more explicit, Trump and Hitler, A Comparative Study in Lying by Henk de Burgh, who teaches at the University of Sheffield and is an expert on comparative literature. His previous book was about Sigmund Freud. Henk, congratulations on the new book, Trump and Hitler. How concretely should we be comparing these two? All you have to do is go on the internet, which is seems to be obsessed with two people, Donald Trump and Adolf Hitler. Should we be serious, or is this more of a metaphorical comparison?
No, I think there is a serious comparison to be made here. The first thing to say, of course, is that on one level, these two men are very different. Trump was, as far as I can tell, not particular, is, as far as I can tell, not particularly ideologically committed, whereas Hitler, of course, was. Hitler was a convinced anti-Semite and racist. I think Trump is only, in inverted commas, playing to white nationalist sentiment. And of course, Hitler instigated the Second World War and was responsible for the Holocaust. So on that level, they are completely different. There is, however, an important parallel in the sense that both men are consummate political performance artists. And I think if we want to understand their success, if we want to understand their rhetoric and why it resonated and resonates in the case of Trump with so many people, we've got to look at this performative aspect of their politics.
But any successful politician, Henk, by definition, is a successful performative artist. You could look at all the various neo-authoritarians in Europe. I mean, you think of Berlusconi, who was one of the models for this new authoritarianism. He was a performative artist. Putin, in his own way, is a performative artist. He appeared in topless on horseback. So what makes, I mean, I take your point that they are both remarkable performers, but what distinguishes them from other successful populist politicians? Modi, maybe not so much Orban, certainly Erdogan in Turkey.
Yes, that is right. So all politicians have to be actors. You can't be a reasonably successful or a very successful politician without being a good actor. This applies even more to populist politicians. And Trump is a populist politician. And of course, Hitler was a populist politician as well. We tend to think of Hitler above all as a would-be autocrat before he came to power. And then when he came to power in 1933, he was a dictator and ultimately a murderous and genocidal dictator. That is the way we look at Hitler, and rightly so. But Hitler was also a populist. And I think the difference between Trump and Hitler and possibly Kim Jong-un in North Korea on the one hand, and these other populist leaders that you've talked about, is the extent to which they rely on their political performances in order to get their ideas through, in order to become successful. So if you look at Putin, for example, I think Putin is much more a politician in the mold of Stalin. It's interesting if we compare Hitler and Stalin. So Stalin was really someone who didn't like to speak in public. He was not a very good public speaker. He actually always had a very strong Georgian accent when he was speaking Russia. He came from Georgia, from that part of Russia. He was a behind-the-scenes kind of guy, and he ruled through fear. So there's this rather wonderful or awful anecdote about Stalin that was told by one of the people who worked for him and was lucky enough to survive. He said the problem with Stalin was if you came into Stalin's office and you didn't look Stalin in the eye, then Stalin thought, you know, this guy is up to something. He's plotting against me, and he would send you to Siberia. But if you came into Stalin's office and you did look him in the eye, then Stalin would think, oh, this person is way too confident. He's probably plotting against me, and he would send you to Siberia. And if you came into Stalin's office and you sometimes looked him in the eye and sometimes didn't look him in the eye, then Stalin would think, oh, this guy is being very shifty, and he would send you to Siberia. So Stalin ruled above all by...
He sent a lot of people to Siberia, Hank, and we know that, but...
Yeah, so he was... he ruled by fear, right? Not so much by his political performance. And this is the case with Hitler and Trump. They do rule through their political performance. And I think this is also where we tend to underestimate them. We tend to see them as loose cannons, right? The picture we have of Hitler is, say, the picture of the actor Bruno Ganz in the film Downfall, right? A politician who loses it very, very quickly, who bites the carpet on the slightest occasion. This is the picture we have of Hitler. But actually, that is entirely wrong. We know from testimony of people who worked with Hitler that he was an incredibly devious politician, a brilliant actor, and that all these outbursts of anger were actually faked. And we have the same with Trump. If we look at Trump and the way people have spoken about Trump, they say, oh, this is a guy who watches 6 or 8 hours of television a day. This is a guy who's not in control of his emotions, who lashes out indiscriminately and so on. And again, this is not true. Trump, too, just like Hitler, uses outbursts of anger strategically. He isn't actually angry. He's pretending to be angry in order to get things done.
You talked earlier about the differences between Hitler and Trump. Yes. And the fact that Hitler believed in something and Trump doesn't. And of course, Hitler seemed, at least from his writings and behavior, to actually love culture or certain kinds of Germanic culture, even if he didn't perhaps quite understand them. Doesn't seem as if Trump believes in anything. He is, it seems to me, I haven't written the book about this, though, a product of a certain kind of American fantasy, as you say, someone who watches television 8 to 10 hours a day. He could have stepped out of the movie being there in some ways. Has all this television watching, does that make him a performative artist, or are the kind of performative artists that you're interested in, are they drawn to media? Do they sit in front of the television half the day and the rest of the day perform on television? Do you need to essentially be a replica of someone from being there to be so skilled as Trump clearly is on television and in social media?
Yes, if you work, in the case of Trump, less through specific policy proposals. And it's quite extraordinary. If you listen to Trump, almost about any topics, with any topic he talks about, he will say things like, You know, we will have great medical insurance. It'll be fantastic medical insurance. It will be the best medical insurance system the world has ever seen. If you then try and pin him down, he will just say the same things. There's almost no specificity to it.
But a lot of politicians, Henk, do that as well. I mean, he's not unusual in that sense. They just repeat the same thing endlessly, and in the end, the questioner gets bored and moves on to the next subject.
Yes, but most other politicians do have concrete proposals. In the case of Trump, the quantitative difference of his emptiness compared to the emptiness of other politicians is so great that it actually, in my view, becomes a qualitative leap. So Trump works above all not by putting forward very specific ideas, but rather by playing a certain kind of personality, by saying, I am the leader who will be your voice. I will take up the cudgels for you, and then thinking largely, I think, of, you know, the white Americans, and especially white American man, although by no means only man, who feel that they have been abandoned by the system. So if you project that image, and both Trump and Hitler project this image of, we are, on the one hand, regular guys, ordinary people, and on the other hand, we are special. We are the country's savior. So their spiel, their stick, as it were, is to say, we are like all of you, but unlike any of you.
Right? But it's so, very convenient, Henk, that Hitler, that your version of Hitler and Trump only appeal to white men. But Hitler was enormously popular with German women, many German women. Trump is increasingly popular, not just with women, but with black and brown Americans. So it's not just a message to white men. I mean, these people can perform across genders and colors, can't they?
Yes, that's true. So I'll come back to that in a moment, just to tackle your question about watching television. If you're trying, above all, to project a particular image, then one of the things you know that is central is the way you are perceived by other people. Hitler was very much aware of this as well. Hitler, in his youth, attended the sessions of the Austro-Hungarian Parliament. Now, the Austro-Hungarian Parliament at the time was the biggest parliament in the world, with 500 seats. These people were speaking 30 different languages, this is my previous book.
That was your Freudian era.
Yes. Hitler would observe what was going on there, and then realize most of these politicians are only talking to other politicians. What you've got to do is you've got to be received in a certain way by the populace. So Hitler, literally on a daily basis, had all through the 1930s and until 1945, when he committed suicide, every single day, newspapers from all over the world would be delivered to him with the key articles translated. Hitler didn't want summaries. Hitler wanted the original texts in German translation, because he only read German. And he did that on a daily basis, because he needed to know what his media image was. And that is the reason that Trump watches so much television, not because he's lazy, but he needs to keep a tab on his media image.
But you're presenting it again as some sort of conspiracy. I mean, he's a guy who spent his whole life watching television. It wasn't as if 30 years ago he thought to himself, okay, I'm going to become president, so I'm going to watch a lot of television. For him, television and digital media, that's the reality. There isn't another reality for him, is there?
Well, but this is because as a businessman, he operated basically the way he's operating now as a politician, or maybe it would be better to say that his political career is kind of an extension in terms of the performative aspects of his business career. And we see that now, where Trump, is actually has to pay a heck of a lot of money, because he kept overvaluing and undervaluing the financial worth of his company as far as I can tell, to a greater extent than other companies and CEOs do. Trump always worked through being Trump the spectacle, making sure that he was in the news. If you think of all these other big companies, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, it's very hard to think of any names of CEOs and managing directors because they work behind the scenes. Trump always put himself forward, and the way he made his business successful, most obviously then when he branched out into The Apprentice and wrestling and the Miss Universe pageant and so on, but also before that, when he was basically a builder and building all these buildings, he built his company on his personality. So that's why television and newspapers were always...
He is the model, perhaps the pioneering model of a brand who acquires different industries. There's a piece today in Axios about whether Truth Social, which is his latest thing,
yes,
will face the same fate as Trump's casinos, which is bankruptcy, and Trump always seems to escape. There's the roadrunner element of Trump. He always seems to escape. But, you know, I take all your points and they make sense. But seriously, Hank, is Trump's business career is uniquely American, a feature of a peculiar kind of perhaps post-industrial American capitalism. It's nothing to do with Hitler. And when you start comparing Trump and Hitler, it becomes absurd. You get completely the wrong image of Trump. He's an interesting figure historically, but in that sense, he shares nothing in common with Hitler. Hitler wasn't a businessman. He didn't really have his own brand. He certainly didn't continually bankrupt other people. So where's the comparison there?
Oh, the comparison, in fact, is that they're both outsiders.
Big deal. A lot of outsiders. I mean, that's so what?
There are not that many outsiders who get into politics, become the leader of their country without having been, experienced politicians. Again, if you look at someone like Putin, who sort of slowly rose up the ranks, and this is the case of most politicians.
Well, he was, but Hitler isn't an outsider like, Trump isn't an outsider like Hitler. Trump was a wannabe insider from Queens, a wealthy man who perhaps wasn't quite as accepted by establishment Manhattan as he liked, but he certainly wasn't the kind of outsider that Hitler was. Completely unknown ex-wannabe painter, wounded in the First World War. He wasn't even German, he was Austrian. So calling Trump and Hitler outsiders is a little ambitious. It's almost Trumpian, isn't it?
No, I don't think it is. They are both political outsiders. So if you look at the context in which they operated, right? So Hitler, the rise of Hitler begins after the First World War, where Germany, before the First World War, was this great economic and military powerhouse. Then there's the First World War, which Germany loses. Then you have the Treaty of Versailles that imposes punishing reparations on Germany. Germany then actually loses 13% of its territory and all the colonies after the defeat in the First World War, after the demise of the empire. Then Germany becomes a democratic state, the so-called Weimar Republic, but it's challenged right from the start with 700 political murders in the first few months. Most people don't actually believe in this new democratic system. There's massive unemployment. There's lots and lots of crime. So all the former glory, all the wealth and power of the empire then has disappeared. So people, ordinary Germans, feel there's no terra firma anymore. There's no firm ground on which we can stand. Then in 1922, 1923, you've got this massive hyperinflation that we all know about. Then Germany is no longer able to pay the reparations imposed on it by the Treaty of Versailles. So French and Belgian troops then occupy the Rhineland. This is the first time ever, didn't happen during the First World War, but now foreign troops are on German soil. Then there's a coup d'etat in 1921. There's another coup d'etat in 1923, actually done by Hitler.
Yeah, I take all these points, but there's no equivalent to the United States. So the early 20s in Germany are in completely foreign to the early 2020s in the United States. There's no comparisons at all.
That's where I disagree, Andrew. I think the similarity is in the fact that you have this situation in which, for ordinary Germans, everything seems to be in flux. Everything they believed in, everything they that was part of their parents' and their grandparents' generation, all that's falling away. So they have this massive insecurity, and they have this, and they have the feeling that this newly minted democratic system, the Weimar Republic, isn't working for them. Now, if we look at the United States today, yes, of course, on the one hand, you're right, this is a very different situation. It's not a post-war United States that we're looking at. We're not seeing hundreds of political assassinations and all the rest of it. But it is a society in flux, right? So America's prestige was dented, certainly after 9/11, then there were these fairly unsuccessful wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, interventions in Syria and Libya that were not particularly successful. So many people have spoken about how we're now living in a post-American world. So that has disappeared. Then you look at the United States economically, and it's been hit by automation and globalization. I mean, we all know this, right?
I have to admit, I find this profoundly unconvincing. You talk about America in flux. All societies are always in flux. We're going to come back to this. We need to take a break. It's an interesting conversation with my guest, Henk de Burg, author of Trump and Hitler, A Comparative Study in Lying. When it comes to telling the truth, though, Liberties does a good job, a quarterly journal of culture and politics. I'm going to run a short feature on Liberties, and then we'll be back with Henk de Burg to talk more about Hitler, Trump, the comparisons, whether they're for real or not. So don't go away, anyone. We'll be back in a second.
News, the noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. We are speaking with Henk de Burg, the author of Trump and Hitler, A Comparative Study in Lying. Before the break, Henk was trying to make the case, which I have to admit I strongly disagree with, but the condition of America in the 2020s and 2024 isn't that much unlike the Germany of the post-First World War in the early days of Weimar. Henk, you're in Sheffield. When was the last time you were in the U.S.?
So let me just continue on with the comparison I was trying to make, because you sort of kind of cut me off before I was able to give you the full picture. So I think there's the decline of America as a political power with the rise of China, with the rise of India. I think that is difficult for many people. And during the Cold War, there were only two superpowers, and now we live, as I say, in to some extent a post-American world. There's globalization, there's automation. I was going to give the example of banks. It's not that long ago that you could actually go into a physical bank, and get money there. And there were people working there, right? And they would work at that bank and have a job for life, and they would be able to provide for their families. All of that has disappeared. So there's a lot of economic uncertainty, all these short-term jobs, people are losing their jobs and all the rest of it. And at the same time, And this is what I mean when I was talking about the lack of terra firma, the lack of firm ground to stand on, society being in flux much more than ever before. At the same time, we've seen massive cultural changes, right? So the way we now look at women after the Me Too movement, the way we've now become aware of the crimes of colonialism, the discrimination of Black people much more than ever before, especially after the Black Lives Matter movement, the way we now look at gay people and the LGBTQ plus community and so on. These are massive changes that for so many people are insecure. It's easy for us, you know, intellectuals, I think, you know, we're not really impacted by this or not yet. Many people who perhaps don't have a university education or who have more sort of straightforward jobs that can easily be replaced by chatbots or artificial intelligence, they are suffering from this. And you say, well, that this is the case across the world. And yes, you're absolutely right about that. And that is precisely the reason that we see the kind of populism that Trump represents. We see that all over the place, right? In Germany, you've got the Alternative für Deutschland, the AfD party. In Holland, not long ago, the elections were won by this guy called Geert Wilders, who is a right-wing populist. We have Modi in India and so on. So the rise of populism is much to do with the rapid changes, political changes, economic changes, cultural changes that we see. And that is when people then turn to populism and populists. And the question that I try and answer in the book is, so why is a guy like Trump, you know, if you see him, you listen to him, these incoherent, meandering speeches, the simplicity of his proposals to the extent that he has got any proposals at all. Why is this guy, as you indicated at the beginning, if the polls are to be believed, why is this guy now likely to become president again? One of the things that I'm really worried about is the way we still underestimate Donald Trump. We still underestimate his skill set. And I think that looking at the kind of populism that Hitler represented, the way Hitler spoke and Hitler's speeches and so on, and we can talk about that in a little bit more detail if you want, that helps us give a better understanding of Trump. Just as I think that looking at Hitler, who again is always seen as, you know, a guy who loses it on the slightest occasion and is a murderous dictator. First, not true. Second, definitely true. He was a murderous dictator. But to try and see Hitler, Hitler's fatal attraction, to understand that better, I think it is useful to look at.
Point. But I asked you a question earlier. You've got this analysis of America, which in my view is entirely wrong. The idea of, you know, everyone being concerned about the rise of India. I've never met any American who even knows where India is, let alone its rise. When were you last in America? How do you derive your sense of what America is? It seems as if there's this vision of America in Europe, which is in itself almost Trumpian in its simplicity.
Well,
when were you last in America? Answer that question.
Oh, I don't think it is important to.
Well, it is if you're going to about a country. Where do you get your understanding of? You know, I live in America, and the America you talk about is not the America, it seems to me, that I live in.
Do you think then that America is the same sort of political confidence and the same economic confidence? If that were the case, I think Trump would basically be unexplainable, because then the only way to explain the success of Trump is to say that almost half of Americans are deeply racist. And that seems to me incredibly implausible.
Well, America, though, has been through these cycles before. I mean, we were having this conversation in the early 70s, the defeat in Vietnam, technology. America has always been a society, for better or worse, in flux through technology. There's always some aspect of the economy, some professions, which are being dramatically disrupted by new technologies, new ways of doing business. The core of your book about lying. There's an interesting headline, which perhaps captures how we think about the world. CNBC, Biden said today that the U.S. economy is the world's best. Trump calls it a cesspool. The data is clear. I'm guessing the data is a little bit muddled. when Biden says the U.S. economy is the world's best, that's there's some truth to that. Trump calls it a cesspool. Maybe there's some truth to that. This idea of politics and lying, doesn't it depend on your mode, who you're talking to, your perspective? So when Trump calls the American economy a cesspool, and again, this comes back to the thesis in your book, which I think is right, that he's a performative artist, that's what people expect. He's a social media star, a reality television performer, isn't he? And no one expects him to actually be an economist and be talking concretely about economics.
I think if you're looking at a politician and someone who wants to be president, you would quite like to know what ideas he has about the economy and about other concrete issues. And if a politician has no answer, then with normal politicians, you say, well, I'm not going to vote for that person. Trump then offers different things. And I just want to come back just for one second, and then we can come back to the lying. I do believe that, you know, you talked about the 1970s and America sort of post-Vietnam, but that was a political disaster. We've now got a triple whammy, right? We've got America's relative decline. It's still the strongest country in the world, but other countries are rising. People don't feel that the economy is working for them, even though the figures, sort of the objective data, might show that America is doing better. And then there are these massive cultural changes. I think we can see the sort of intensity with which people feel these things. If we look at the issue of sort of transgenderism, right, where your various sides and all these sides are incredibly invested in this. And that triple whammy, political, economy, and cultural at the same time, I think that uncertainty that has created is comparable to the lack of firm ground that people felt in Weimar in the 1920s. And I actually think, you know, that there is a real lesson here. If we look at Germany in 1928, right? In 1928, the Nazi Party got 2.6% of the vote. In other words, over 97% of the electorate didn't want the Nazi Party. Only 4 or 5 years later, in 1933, Hitler becomes chancellor. So that shows that in admittedly a very extreme situation, post-World War I and all the rest of it, the institutions that we think are sort of fixtures of the political and social landscape can actually disappear very quickly. It shows how people who in the past were against Hitler or thought, oh, we can actually use this guy and ride the tiger, as it were, how they then fall for this guy. And within a space of 5 years, Germany goes from a country where the Nazis have no power to a dictatorship ruled by the Nazis. So when you say things like, well, you know, we've always seen we've seen these things before, and American democracy is strong and so on, then I kind of think, yeah, on the one hand, I agree with that. I don't think that America is not going to become some sort of fascist state, right? That's nonsense. But it can slide towards authoritarianism. And that's the other thing that I think. So on the one hand, I agree with you. These things come and go, same old, same old. But on the other hand, things can go wrong very quickly. And if countries like Holland, Germany, Italy, India and all these other countries can slide towards authoritarianism or worse, why would America be immune to this?
Yeah, that's another subject. As I said, I see no comparisons between America and Weimar, but maybe that's the subject of another conversation. What about you've written about Freud, Hank. You're an expert in literary theory. You've written about the Marxist theorist Ernst Bloch, a very distinguished 20th century Marxist. What would Freud make, and what would traditional Marxists, or maybe not so traditional Marxists like Bloch, what would they say about Trump? Is he a, for the Marxists, is he a manifestation of what they might call late capitalism? And maybe deal with the Marxists first and then a Freudian analysis of Trump.
Yeah, so there is this wonderful sentence in the Communist Manifesto of 1848, all that is solid melts into air, right? And this is the feeling that people had in the early 19th century, the first half of the 19th century, when we see across certainly the Western world, a transformation from the old feudal order, agriculturally based, to a new capitalist class-based order. And all these old traditions, the old political system, the old hierarchies, people's fixed place in the world, all of that is sort of seems to be falling away. That is something that is typical of capitalism, right? Capitalism constantly renews itself and destroying old ties and old ideas in the process, which is both a good thing and a bad thing, right? So I think from a Marxist perspective, if you look at Trump, you would see Trump as someone who is addressing sort of the shortcomings of capitalism. And it's very interesting, if we look at the 2016 election, there was much more sort of traffic, as it were, people shifting from Bernie Sanders to Trump and from Trump to Bernie Sanders, rather than between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. So this idea that the system isn't working, that the establishment are wrong, that we need to come up with an entirely different political system with maybe more power, in the case of Trump, for the president, and so on. A Marxist would put that down, as you say, to the way capitalism is working or is not working for
One of the great 20th century Marxists, Gramsci, the Italian, talked about morbid symptoms of, he described a world, I think, in the 1930s, where the new hadn't been born and the old still lingered and there were these morbid systems. Is Trump himself a manifestation of this Gramscian idea of a morbid symptom?
Yeah, I think you can look at Trump as... And a populism in general, as being located precisely in this sort of transitional period from the old to the new, right? From one way where capitalism was working to a new way, again, globalization, automation, and all the rest of it. I don't want to keep banging on about Weimar, right? But I think you have this sense of the old and the new in Weimar as well. Ernst Bloch actually talks about this specifically when he says, you know, in the Weimar Republic, you have a situation where people are at the same time nationalist and internationalist, right? It's a heavily patriarchal society, but then because so many people died, so many men died in the First World War, we also see the rise of women. It's a situation where you've got lots of agriculture and at the same time heavy industry is incredibly important. So that kind of balancing between old and new and how do you deal with that transition, I think that is one of the reasons.
And then let's finally, because we're running out of time, Hank, what would Freud think about this? And I think perhaps he might make more sense of it than in some ways than the Marxists. How would Freud interpret Trump?
So if we look at the followers of Trump, why are these people voting for Trump, right? Why do they believe that this guy will solve the problems that until now basically no one has been able to solve? And again, I think this is to do with the fact, and I know I keep coming back on the idea of sort of a lack of terra firma and people's insecurity, especially in, as you say, this new period, this transition from the old to the new, then what you tend to do is to use a Freudian term that's first of all displacement, right? So the economy isn't working for you. Now, you want to do something about this, but obviously you can't, because, you know, we individuals are not able to change the economy. And to be frank, not even economists seem to even understand the economy, right? So you can't sort of lash out at the economy. But what you can do is displace the anger you feel towards an economic system that's not working onto a group of outsiders. So you can say the problems we're dealing with are to do with all these Mexican immigrants coming over the border, right? So there you have this mechanism of displacement. So you need an enemy, because you need to make your own community smaller, more tribal, as it were, so that you feel more secure. So in the case of Nazi Germany, becomes what the Germans call the Volksgemeinschaft, the ethnic community, where you paint a picture of the Jews as the outsider and as the real danger. And as long as we deal with what was called the Jewish problem, then everything will be hunky-dory. And Trump gives the same idea, as long as we deal with Mexican immigrants. You know, that is why his, you know, crazy statement that he was going to build this big, beautiful wall between Mexico and the United States, and Mexico would pay for the wall. That's why that resonated with so many people. And if you have enemies, and you yourself are sort of relatively powerless, and you feel that the system isn't working for you, think of the opioid addiction in the United States. Think of the alcohol addiction in the United States. Then you say, well, if the system isn't working, then we need to put our faith in a strong man or a strong man, an authoritarian leader. And I think that's what's happening in the case of Trump. We need one guy to do away with the establishment. And it's interesting if you look at the terminology. So Trump talked about the system and about the swamp. And actually, the National Socialists used exactly the same terms. Das System, the system, and der Sumpf, which means the swamp, right? And they were going to drain the swamp.